think about it, and people who are watching this should think about this too, that how many of their sensory, how much of what they perceive every day is either created by or mediated by humans. And they can ask themselves at this moment how many machines are within 20 feet of them and how many wild plants or animals or fungi are within 20 yards of them. And how many machines do they have a daily relationship with? Computer, phone, television, refrigerator, space heater, you know, what machines do you have a daily relationship with, and car, and on the other hand, how many wild creatures, individual wild creatures, or wild communities do you have a daily relationship with?
Hi, welcome to Peak Moment. I'm Janaea Donaldson. I'm in the very northwest corner of California, and I'm with Derek Jensen, author, activist, philosopher, teacher, all-around brilliant human. Author of Ensiv, Dreams, A Language Older Than Words, and the most recent book, The Myth of Human Supremacy. Derek, thanks for joining me.
Oh, thank you so much for having me again.
You know, you could read the title of this book, and I read the title of the book, and I said, yep, got it. And then, in reading through it, you dissect all kinds of ways that we are thinking, as well as our actions, show that we think we're the top of the world. And I want to thank you. It's just those angles that I had never thought of at all. What I'd love to ask you, though, is what I hear in this, this dominant culture is destroying the earth. And underneath that, I feel in you this fierce love for the natural world. And I wanted to see if you could talk to us about those places or peoples or indigenous peoples that you love, what touches your heart, because that must be what helps feed the earth.
Well, how could we not love this? And even if, you know, I don't love all landscapes, or maybe I don't want to live in all landscapes. I'm not much of a desert person. Mm-hmm. I understand and respect the desert, and I have seen beautiful deserts, but it's not me like forests. Nonetheless, the earth is what gave us life, and the earth supplies all of our food, and it supplies everything. Mm-hmm. And so, even if you were living in a landscape that wasn't one that spoke to you quite so much, it still seems ungrateful not to acknowledge. And it seems even more ungrateful to actually abuse these places that are giving you life. I mean, the earth is the source of all life. It's kind of silly that we don't acknowledge that all the time. But that really wasn't your question. Your question was more about, like, some places or beings I love. And I think for me, when I think about my first love, I think it's meadowlarks. I grew up in Colorado, and I mean, to this day, it is hard for me to hear the sound of a meadowlark without tearing up, because this is one of the most beautiful sounds in the world.
It's evocative. It's haunting.
And also, growing up in Colorado, I also very much love the sound of red-winged blackbirds. And since I live in a place where there are no meadowlarks, there's no meadowlarks in this part of the country, and there's no red-winged blackbirds in this part of the country, a few times when I've been on tour, I have had the opportunity to be someplace where they are native, and I'll just go outside and listen, because I love that sound so much. Another sound that I love very much, I love the sound of Pacific tree frogs here. And if I lived someplace else, I would probably love whatever tree frog was there, but here is Pacific tree frogs. That's one of the things that's been breaking my heart the last 16, 17 years. When I first moved to this area, the frogs were loud enough in the spring outside at night that you couldn't have a human conversation. And they're now, they're still there, but now the sound is, we could still be having this conversation and hear each other speak over the sound of the frog. So it's very much gone down. Those are a couple of my loves. This reminds me of the next thing I was going to say is I was going to go off on pine trees and snow and talk about some other things that I love. But then I was thinking about something that Vine Deloria talks about, or Vine Deloria talked about, he's dead now, that he would talk about how a lot of people will go out hiking and they will come back and think they've had this transformative nature experience. And he said that you certainly could have a transformative nature experience in a couple of days, but that's more of an aesthetic experience, actually, as opposed to the years and decades that it can take to get to know a place. Mm. I mean, think about a romantic relationship and how, or a friendship, doesn't matter, and how there is, I'm saying nothing bad about making new friendships, but also there is a certain something that comes with 10, 15 years of seeing patterns and seeing preferences. And I think that that's true not only of our human relationships, but it's true of our relationships with land, too, where if you live in a place for a long time, you can start to see, the patterns and preferences of, what do these trees like? What do the meadowlarks like in a different place? And to see, one of the smartest things that my mom suggested I do was every year I would get, because of the worldwide amphibian die-off, every year when I first moved here, I would start freaking out in December because I wasn't hearing frogs yet. So my mom suggested that I get a calendar and like a date book, and then I just mark down different things I notice in the book. And so I see, for example, that the frogs where I live should start singing again. A couple of them should be singing in a couple weeks, mm-hmm. and then maybe a few weeks after that, there will be a lot more. I know that the bears usually leave this is mid-January. Here, they usually leave about the end of December. Mm-hmm. And then they'll probably be back with their babies in about April. I have it written down when they'll show up. But the thing is that that's the sort of thing that you have to stay there for a while and attend to and pay attention to actually start to discover. So I guess what I'm trying to get at is that there are multiple forms. As with humans, there are multiple forms of love. There is this sort of, there can be some immediate attraction, and there can be this sort of giddiness of being in this beautiful place. Mm-hmm. And then there is a more profound connection that can come through time. And same with with humans, and I feel like I'm sort of wandering away from...
I want to add, just a little what you're saying here, that first of all, in the book, when you talk about language, you start to use a language of who, you know, a person, subjectivity of, and reminding us that a biotic community like the redwoods you were in, which was very deliberate, I really wanted to be in the redwoods you love, and also my childhood love were redwoods. So it's really heartful to be here and to think of this as a living being, the whole place as a living being. And I'm with you, you know, you've been here, what, a couple decades or more?
17 years.
All right. And we in our land, almost 30. And I understand that. I now know when our little frogs come out, it won't be till February. And you also get to see how your friend, this place you live, does in different kinds of situations, difficult situations. I remember, you know, what it's done when the snow came late and then the oak tree, and the leaves were already starting out on the oaks and it broke a lot of branches. That's an unusual oak threat once. Or the year we had a bounty crop of acorns. And Bear said, excuse me, this is my territory for acorns. You can go elsewhere, but this is my... Those kinds of relationships that only do come with many years of being together. How can you really? Thank you.
So there's a lot in what you said, and I want to know what you want me to respond to.
That's okay. We can move to this. Well, let's look at the chance you and we have had the privilege of being able to live in nature, wilder nature, more on its own terms. But an awful lot of our viewers, an awful lot of the world, are in urban settings where nature is on human terms. How do we begin? I think we will fight for these places because we love them. How do we help encourage other people to fall in love, maybe is the way to say it, with wild nature?
I think part of the problem is that we John Livingston talked about how he thinks that we are all living in echo chambers, because we are actually, even though cities, when I go on tour, I will get to my hotel, I will shut the drapes, I will turn off the lights, and hide. And then I go to dinner, and then I do my event, and then I go back to my room and I shut the drapes. Because I find cities, in one sense, overstimulating. At the end of the day, I mean, I'm not being precious when I'm saying all this. This is just what happens, because otherwise what happens at the end of the day is I feel like all my skin's been rubbed off. I feel like I've been abraded because there's so many people and there's so many sharp corners, and I'm just very tired. And that's just me. So
you're
on
not,
one level,
you're not alone either.
So on one level, cities are very overstimulating, but there's another level at which cities are not. And the way that they're not is that they're actually understimulating in a sense, because think about it, and people who are watching this should think about this too, that how much of what they perceive every day is either created by or mediated by humans. And they can ask themselves at this moment how many machines are within 20 feet of them and how many wild plants or animals or fungi are within 20 yards of them. And how many machines do they have a daily relationship with? Computer, phone, television, refrigerator, space heater, you know, what machines do you have a daily relationship with? And car. And on the other hand, how many wild creatures, individual wild creatures, or wild communities do you have a daily relationship with? And so what we evolved in this, and this is our home. And one of the things that John Livingston talks about is that he calls that having all of your sensory perceptions either created by or mediated by humans, he says you can start to hallucinate. And just like anybody else in echo chamber does. And the hallucinations, he thinks that all of our ideologies are hallucinations. Mm. And that all of what you read in the newspaper, they're basically hallucinations. And there's a sense, that seems kind of crazy on one level, but a sense in which we can all understand that is they all make humans the center of the universe. And that's one of the things that happens in the cities. You can start to believe that your food does not come from the land. Your food comes from the grocery store.
Right.
Your water doesn't come from a river. It comes from the tap.
Right. Yes.
And it's the same with everything else, that everybody else is peripheral. I just was reading this article the other day by some supposed environmentalist who is saying, we need to ask, which creatures can we not survive without? I'm like, that's not the point. That's not the point at all. The point is, which creatures does the land want? And which...
And so there's this
idea. This is why we end up... Every day you hear about the stock market, but every day you don't hear about how the world is doing, how the real world's doing. When people... I used to teach at a college, and my students would say, when I get out in the real world, I'm going to have to get a job. What the real world means for them
is the work world of humans.
The work world.
Yeah.
Everybody, a lot of people use it that way.
That's right.
As opposed to, this is actually the real world. So those are some of the hallucinations. And so it can be very easy, especially in a city, to forget that there is a real world. But having said that, one of my books was about how terrible zoos are. And one of the reasons that people go to zoos is because I think we have especially children, have an absolutely necessary and instinctual need to interact with non-human animals.
I think that is true.
And plants.
I think that is true.
And Paul Shepard really made the case that there are developmental stages at which you need to do it so you can learn how to categorize.
To categorize.
So like you see, this is a furry animal. You see, at 3 years old, you see, okay, furry, scaly. I now understand the difference, and I see. And I see four-legged, I see winged. I see big, I see small. That's how you start to be able to think and to be able to develop some of the skills, the cognitive skills that you use for the rest of your life. So that's one reason that people have to go to zoos. The people in cities end up going to zoos.
Right.
But I talk about, in that book, I talk about that it's teaching them terrible lessons. Yes, they go there because we need to see a bear. We need to see a bird. But the problem is, this is presenting them as being there at our insistence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there was, before I wrote the zoo book, I went to a zoo in Detroit. I had to go to a zoo before I could write about it, really. And there was this little button that outside many of the cages that you could push, and it would do this sing-song voice that would sing, "All the animals at the zoo are waiting here just for you."
Oh, wow.
So that's the lesson that's being taught. Now let's think about this in terms of pornography. You know, all the women on the net, they're just, all the women at the website, they're waiting there with legs open just for you. It's absolutely pornographic. As opposed to the real life where, you know, I may want something with you and you don't want something with me. Or want to talk to you, you don't want to talk to me.
You come out here into the real world, and whether chipmunk shows up or squirrel is up to them.
Up to them
and
completely.
And they know exactly where you are. They hear us two-footed all the time.
And they
tell each other.
And they may want to hang out with you and they may not. And it's
exactly.
And that's an entirely different lesson. Or like, you know, my mom has very close relationships with a lot of bears. And she sees them all the time. And through her, I end up seeing them too. And there was one bear that really started this relationship with my mom. And my mom and I call her Mama. And we haven't seen her for 4 or 5 years. And that's not particularly worrisome, because usually with bears, females will claim a territory and then other females aren't supposed to go there. So there have been other females instead. Mama may be dead, or she may be living happily in Klamath. She may be...
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And here's the point. We will probably never know. And that's something that you have to accept when you're working with... When you're in relationship with the real world. This a meadowlark can show up, can sing some beautiful song, and then it flies away, and maybe it is perfectly happy a mile away, or maybe it's dead, or maybe...
Yeah.
And that's... There is this idea that we have to know everything. I mean, that's sort of the scientific idea, too, that there is nothing that can be beyond our knowledge. But that's something you have to accept in nature, is that you just never know. And you don't control it. That's the point. And
yes.
to bring this all
yes.
back to the city is, so I'm writing this book, and I think, okay, so what do people in cities do? Because I think zoos are just terrible. So what I decided to do is I went to the least hospitable place that I could find in this small town of Crescent City, not here, you know, a couple miles south mm-hmm. in Crescent City. I went to the McDonald's parking lot. And I'm sitting in the parking lot, and I just sit there for a while. And I get out of the car, and I sit at the edge of the parking lot near where there's some decorative bushes. And it takes me about 5 minutes, and I start seeing seagulls, and I start seeing ants, and I start seeing bumblebees, and... My point is that even in the city, people can find someone to love. They can. I know people who have grown up. I just got a note from somebody the other day who was saying that he's absolutely heartbroken because the trees on the street where he grew up have been cut down in the last... I don't know if he went back to see them mm-hmm. and they got mm-hmm. cut or something, mm-hmm. but... So one can still have this intimate, profound affection with non-humans, even in a city. One can...
Yes, yes, yeah.
I mean, in a city, one can still look a pigeon in the eye, and that's still a wild creature who can come and go.
I think for many people in this culture at this point, it would seem that we need to... Encourage those relationships, you know, especially for young children. I can imagine, you know,
it's very, very difficult because I had a friend when I lived in Spokane who would take part of her job was to take children from schools to parks, city parks in Spokane. So it's, you know, at least it's green.
Yeah.
And, like, to the Botanic Garden.
Oh, okay.
And
okay.
I remember her telling me that she was just horrified because some of these students would run away from butterflies because they'd never seen a butterfly before and they thought it was going to bite them or sting them or something. And if you have that level of terror of the natural world, well, for one thing, that suggests that there is a lot of terror within that child anyway, and there are some other things we can discuss having to do with the child's upbringing. But in addition, there is that level of fear of the natural world is something that is certainly inculcated by this culture, and it's something that I'm trying to think of the right word. I don't know if the word is overcome. Grown past? Something that needs to be... that somehow needs to be assuaged. I don't know what mm-hmm. word, but there's some word there that needs to be made so they're no longer afraid.
Healed.
There we go.
Deep way, if so, they can find it's not nature red in tooth and claw and an enemy and other. I think that's a big piece
of
it.
Well, it is an other.
It is other, but that the other is something to be afraid of.
And so here's part of the deal, too, and this takes us back to the book. I've heard it said that unquestioned assumptions are the real authorities of any culture. And when this notion that even evolution, life itself, is based on ruthless competition and exploitation, that's how we'll act. When we believe that life itself is exploitative. So we often hear that evolution is based on competition and it's ruthless and it's survival of the fittest, the meanest, the most capitalist, the most exploitative, the most abusive. But if you believe that, that will cause you to act in that fashion. But there is to sort of show how silly our discourse is in this culture, I can disprove that evolution is based primarily on competition in one sentence, if you give me a couple semicolons. And that's those creatures who've survived in the long run have survived in the long run, semicolon. You don't survive in the long run by hyper-exploiting your surroundings, semicolon. You survive in the long run by actually improving your habitat. Because if by living, you make your habitat worse, over long term, your habitat will continue to get worse and worse until it's destroyed. As opposed to, how do we think that this world got to be so wild and fecund and beautiful in the first place? It didn't start at this great place and then go down. Obviously, it's been built up. How did it get built up? It got built up by salmon living and dying. And every salmon living and dying makes the forest a better place by its life and death. And every bear then makes the forest a better place by its life and death. And every tree makes the forest a better place by its sprouting and by its falling. That's the point, is how do you make the world a better place? This is, once again, we believe that life is a giant game of risk or monopoly, where the point is to run the board, to accumulate as much as you can. There's even I've heard a lot of biologists even talk about a measure of biological success is how many of you there are. And that's not really a measure of biological success. That's a measure of capitalist success, is how much money you've made. That's a measure of colonial success, how much of the world you can take over. Biological success is how long have you lived there, and is the habitat better because you are? How long can you live there in the future? And so I don't think that life is like a game of risk. I think that life is like a giant symphony where the role, like Vine Deloria says, is to learn what role you are to play, and then to play at the proper time. The point is not for the violin players to go kill the oboe players and kick them out of the symphony and to take over so you have nothing but a bunch of violin players. The point is to figure out where you will sound best, and then to play that. That's the point, is how do we all work together?
I like that. The symphony together. Thank you. Let's pause for a moment, because I want to hear more about intelligences, right? You're watching Peak Moment. I'm Janaea Donaldson with Derek Jensen, and we'll be back for more